96.9, Boston Talks.
Josh Davis is on News Talk 96.9.
This is News Talk 96.9, where Boston connects. I am Josh Davis. I am here until 9 o'clock here also during the week, every day, Monday through Thursday at 10:30 with Doug Meehan on The Doug Meehan Show. And this week, in the last hour of Friday's Michael Graham Show from 6 to 7, live in studio with Michael Graham. Hopefully, we'll both get out alive. Everybody listening knows the name Trayvon Martin and remembers the story of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. We'll hear about that again when that case goes to trial. But I want to tell you about the death of a young man in Florida named Jordan Russell Davis, not a relative. Jordan Russell Davis's death strikes me as the time for all of us to stand up and take notice of the insanity of the Stand Your Ground laws that have swept this nation. Let me tell you what happened to Jordan Davis. Let me tell you what his killer, Michael David Dunn, says is his defense. And then let's talk together about whether we've gone too far down this Stand Your Ground road. The number is 617-822-1969. Pound 96.9 is a free call on Verizon Wireless. I want to be very clear. This is not a conversation about gun control. This is a conversation about a particular statute and its impact on cultures in which people carry guns. Here's what happened. Michael David Dunn, 45 years old, is in Jacksonville, Florida, with his girlfriend for his son's wedding. They pull up in a car outside a convenience store in Jacksonville, Florida. So they drive into the store and pull up next to a car in which Jordan Russell Davis and his friends are sitting, listening to, by any standard, extremely loud music. While Michael Dunn's girlfriend is in the store, Dunn tells Jordan Russell Davis and his three friends to turn down the music. Quote, it was loud, close quote, Jacksonville homicide Lieutenant Rob Scuvener said of the teen's music. They admitted that, quote, that's not a reason for someone to open fire, close quote. After an exchange of words, Dunn began shooting with a handgun, Scuvener said. Nobody else in the vehicle was struck. He only shot Davis. And that was lucky, the lieutenant said, because the guy shot the car 8 or 9 times. Dunn then drove away and was arrested the next morning after learning on the news that someone had been killed in the car. Dunn said when he was arrested that he saw a shotgun somewhere in the car that Davis was driving, and that is accordingly, his lawyer has begun to argue, he was privileged to kill or allowed to kill Davis under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Now, we all learned in the Trayvon Martin case that the way Stand Your Ground works is if you are reasonably in fear of your life, you do not have to, under Florida law or other state laws that have the Stand Your Ground law, retreat. You can instead open fire to protect yourself. Now, the Trayvon Martin case has been interesting on a lot of levels because there's lots of room to talk and wonder about what happened between Zimmerman and Martin before Zimmerman shot Martin. And there's been a ton of press about it. There's no room to wonder about what happened between Jordan Russell Davis and Michael Dunn before he was shot. The only question is whether there was a gun in Jordan Russell Davis's car. Now, here's the catch on that one. The catch on that one is they have not found a gun. And what does Michael Dunn's lawyer say about that? He says, how hard did they look? How hard did they look? Now, it appears that his lawyer at least thinks that Dunn believing that he was threatened, whether it was true or not, is sufficient to allow him to shoot him. Now, there are some interesting statistics in the world because, remember, the Martin-Zimmerman incident. Zimmerman, part of what was going on was, at least arguably, his reaction to a young, strong black man in a hoodie. Part of what appears to have been going on here is Michael Dunn, white dude's, reaction to 4 black teenagers in a car listening to loud music. And before you say that that's unwarranted, that conclusion, let me tell you what the Civil Rights Commission has learned. The Civil Rights Commission launched an investigation to stand your ground laws earlier this year. They discovered that reports of justifiable homicides, that is, killings that are okay under the law, have nearly doubled from 2005 to 2011 in states where that legislation has passed. And that in those same states, white killers of black victims comprise only 3.1% of all the homicides. So you get that, all the murders in those states with which have stand your ground laws, only 3.1% of those homicides are white people killing black people. 15.6% of justifiable homicides or claimed justifiable homicides in those cases, in those states, white people killing black people. In other words, part of what we're seeing with the stand your ground laws are killings that have an undeniable racial element. The notion being that somehow a white person is privileged to feel afraid, in peril, because they're near noisy teenagers who happen to be black. It's just wrong. It's what happened to Jordan Russell Davis. Now, the question is, is there room for a law like this? Is there a way to have a law like this that makes sense? My view is you've got to do better than what we have right now, but what we have right now isn't okay. What's your view? 617-822-1969, #969. It's a free call on Verizon Wireless. More about Stand Your Ground with Josh Davis on News Talk 96.9. Josh Davis. This is News Talk 96.9, where Boston connects. And I'm here till 9 o'clock live. We are talking about Jordan Russell Davis and Michael Dunn. Jordan Russell Davis, 17-year-old African-American high school student, shot outside a convenience store in Jacksonville, Florida, by a 45-year-old white man, Michael David Dunn, who asked him to turn down the music in the car, and then, when they argued about it, decided or says that he saw a gun, a shotgun, in Davis's car, and so he shot him. Shot the car 7 or 8 times. Jordan Russell Davis dead. Stand your ground is the defense here. In other words, he was allowed to kill him. I don't think that's right. And I think we should be talking about these laws which lead to a circumstance in which white people killing black people say that it was justified because they were afraid.
Josh Davis is on News Talk 96.9.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 79 years old. There is a serious possibility of turnover on the Supreme Court during the next 4 years. One, maybe two justices. If Ginsburg were to be replaced by a Romney appointee, Roe versus Wade would be very much in question. Now, we'll talk later about how this impacts the Mass Senate race, but right now, is this going to be a critical issue for undecided voters? I think it might be. I wonder what you think. Joe from Dedham, you're on 96.9 with Josh Davis. What's your view? On 96.9 Boston Talks, it's 7:33, and as powerful and famous as Taylor Swift's breakup song is, Will Saladin of Slate Magazine broke up with Paul Ryan last week, and he's on the line, and we're going to talk about it. Will, how are you?
Good, Josh. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So prior to your calling, we've been talking about honesty in politics and Ryan's speech, and I've had a number of people who I think have memorized your Why I Love Paul Ryan piece, call it and talk to me about the only adult in the room and a willingness to talk about fiscal issues like no one else. And it'd be great, I think, if you'd take a minute and just tell me about your love affair with this guy.
Well, I love what Paul Ryan talks about. I love the things that he claims to stand for. And honestly, if that were just his job, if his only job were to remind everybody that you can't promise the world, you have to pay for things, you have to make the books balance, and sometimes you have to say no and you have to cut programs because you've overpromised. That would be swell with me. Unfortunately, the more I dug into his record, and again, I have to confess that my first pass at this, I just hadn't done my homework.
I have to confess, too, that when I read what you wrote, not only did I immediately share it with the entire English-speaking world, but I scared the living daylights out of my family by sounding more like a Republican than I ever had, because I agree with you about at least the version of Paul Ryan that is about having a conversation about the trouble we're in a different way than the other politicians have had it. So what happened is you did more research?
Well, his record doesn't add up to what he tells other people to stand for and what he claims to stand for. So he just doesn't practice what he preaches. Two glaring examples in this campaign. He speaks for getting the budget under control, not promising people everything, but he has been going around to states that have a lot of workers who work for companies that are dependent on the defense budget and basically telling them, President Obama is cutting the defense budget. This will cost jobs in your state. This will cost you a job. Now, we don't need Republicans to be doing that. We have a party that goes around telling people that government cuts will cost you your job and therefore we need a bigger government. It's called the Democratic Party. If the Republican Party is going to stand for something, if it's going to be useful in the national conversation, it can't be doing that. The second thing is they're going around, this is a major part of the Republican campaign, is to claim that Democrats are going to take away your Medicare, that they are cutting Medicare, and that therefore that this is somehow evil. This, by the way, is how Democrats got elected for 30 years.
Right, by promising that under no circumstances would Medicare be cut. Can you dissect this piece of Republican rhetoric for us? Because in the conversations I've had with folks on this program, there is this growing sense that what Ryan's done, in addition, of course, to finding his mother's endorsement, has been to point out the degree to which the president is threatening Medicare. And I'm with you. I know it's not true, but explain why it doesn't work.
Well, if we had had a Republican president, a smart Republican president for the last 4 years, that president would have done exactly what President Obama is doing, which is to reduce the overpayments that we are making to private providers and private insurers under the Medicare Advantage program. It's very complicated, but basically it is a cost saving that any intelligent conservative president would have done. But Barack Obama did it, and therefore the Republicans are attacking him for it. By saving this money, Obama actually he slows the rate of bleeding out of Medicare, out of the Medicare funds, and therefore extends the life of Medicare. Again, any Republican would have defended the program, would have defended the savings on those grounds. So when Ryan and Romney say that they're going to reverse this, what they're basically saying is they're going to pump more money out of Medicare faster and therefore will deplete the funds more quickly. And by 8 years, I believe, is the estimate according to CBO. They're going to make the program run out 8 years faster. So we have essentially a total reversal of the party positions on this issue.
Right. And it's so that what you're hearing is traditionally Democratic rhetoric from the Republicans and conservative rhetoric from the supposedly almost communist president.
Yeah.
We have just 2 minutes left, and what I want to get from you is your take on how the Republicans did last week. I thought Romney's speech was probably as good as he could do, particularly after he survived the fear factor walkthrough, shaking all those hands on the way to the podium.
Yeah, my short take on the convention, and particularly Romney's speech, is Romney gave a great speech for Romney. And more than that, the couple of hours before Romney's speech really humanized the guy. I thought basically the Mormon speakers who talked about his work within his congregation,
they should have been on so much later at night. They were fabulous.
Right. If you had to go back in time as a Republican strategist, you would have axed Clint Eastwood and you would have put those people right before the speech. Mm-hmm. But Romney's essential problem is, even though that was a very good speech for Romney, he himself cannot do what those people tried to do for him, which was he cannot present the real Mitt Romney to people. He just has a problem, like Al Gore did, in being himself in a large group of people. And this is a fatal problem for a candidate. No one can fix that problem for Mitt. No one else can testify for him the way that he needs to show people who he is.
And how important do you think that factor, the likability, factor ultimately will be in this election?
Enormously important, because the objective economic data are not in favor of Obama. They're not fatal to him, but they're not as good as other presidents who've been reelected. So objectively speaking, Obama should be doing worse. And the reason he isn't is that people like Obama more than they like Romney. The best statistic on this race, 60 to 30% white people in this country find the black president more likable than the white Republican nominee. That is an amazing statistic, and it testifies to the emotional power that Obama still has.
No, it's a absolutely remarkable statistic. And the question, I guess, becomes, can you survive 8% unemployment and get reelected just because people like you better?
96.9, Austin Talks.
Appreciate the call, and I agree entirely with this piece, which is that at the end of the day, one of the most powerful ways for us to express our opinion in this country is by choosing not to be part of organizations that believe things we disagree with. And what we're talking about right now is the Boy Scouts of America and their decision not to give an Eagle Scout award to a young man who earned it but happened to be gay. That's where we are on News Talk 96.9 with Josh Davis. This is News Talk 96.9, where Boston connects, and I'm live with you up until 9 o'clock, 617-822-1969, pound 96.9. It's a free call on Verizon Wireless. We are talking about the Boy Scouts of America, and particularly Ryan Anderson, a young man who by age 17 completed everything he had to be an Eagle Scout and was told at the last minute that he could not be an Eagle Scout and could not even be in the Scouts because of his homosexuality. Three quick points. First, the Boy Scouts have been clear about their ban on people of homosexual orientation for a long time. Second, it's legal, according to the Supreme Court of the United States. Third, at least to me, it's not okay. And the question is, what do you do if it's not okay? We're talking about two different ideas. One, do you pull your kids out if you disagree? Augustina from Newton has done just that. And second, should Barack Obama, the President of the United States, resign as honorary President of the Boy Scouts? I sure think so. I think if he's serious about sexual orientation equality, marriage equality, and civil rights for people who are gay, he needs to do that. But that's what I think. The question is, what do you think? News Talk 96.9, a little after 8 in the evening on Sunday. I'm Josh Davis. I'm with you live until 9 o'clock. And the Patriots just beat the Jets. They didn't cheat to do it. Lance Armstrong won a number of Tour de Frances. He cheated to do it. We're going to talk about Lance Armstrong, but you can't possibly have a conversation about Lance Armstrong without thinking about the important role he played in the classic movie Dodgeball. And so before we get to our guest, let's all just listen to Lance Armstrong and Vince Vaughn.
Lance Armstrong?
Yeah, that's me. No, but I'm a big fan of yours.
I think you better hurry up or you're going to be late.
Actually, I decided to quit.
Lance. Quit? You know, once I was thinking about quitting when I was diagnosed with brain, lung, and testicular cancer all at the same time. But with the love and support of my friends and family, I got back on the bike, and I won the Tour de France 5 times in a row. But I'm sure you have a good reason to quit. So what are you dying from that's keeping you from the finals?
Right now, it feels a little bit like shame.
Well, I guess if a person never quit when the going got tough, they wouldn't have anything to regret for the rest of their life. But good luck to you, Peter. I'm sure this decision won't haunt you forever.
So that clip has pretty much disappeared from the internet. It sounds a lot different today than it did in the movie when it was funny because of the greatness that Lance Armstrong in so many ways personified. With us is Reed Neuwreiter. Reed is a leading trial lawyer in the city of Denver, Colorado, where he works at a firm called Hush Blackwell. But more importantly for present purposes, he is the founder of something called the Park Hill Peloton, which is a cycling club, and the author of an article called Lance Armstrong's Legal War that's going to make its way into press next week. Reed, welcome to News Talk 96.9.
I'm delighted to be on the radio, Josh.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Can you, for those of us like me who know about Lance Armstrong only from a distance, give us some perspective on who he was in the context of cycling and in sport as a whole?
Well, in the context of cycling, he was the patron, the boss, the greatest champion of the Tour de France, which is, some say, the most difficult athletic event in the world. It's essentially the equivalent of running 20 marathons in a row for 20 days over some of the highest mountains in Europe. And so he won it 7 times in a row, never been done before. He won... He had been won 5 times before. And then he was almost a messianic figure, a Jesus-like recovery from near-death experience with cancer.
And that's what the dodgeball clip refers to, is the overcoming this impossible disease. And it turns out that he overcame it, I guess, as a health matter, but the winning not so much as a result of his internal greatness.
No, that's right. And what the legal problems he's got right now relate to the United States Anti-Doping Agency's release of a report, 200 pages long with 1,000 pages of attachments and affidavits, including 11 by former riders on his team, including his best friend, the most respected rider in the, it's called the Peloton, the group of riders.
I'm sorry, I said that wrong.
That's all right.
I was trying to sound French.
The group of professional riders who ride in the big races in Europe, George Hincapie, and they all say that Lance, number one, not only did he dope to win, and then he lied about it, but he was really part of a doping conspiracy, the distribution of drugs, encouraging, in fact, requiring young riders on his team through management to use drugs in order to compete, because cycling is really a team sport, and a single leader, even if the single leader is on drugs, unless the rest of his team is on drugs and helping him and able to keep up, he's not going to be able to be successful. So he had a very sophisticated doping conspiracy in order to win.
When you say doping conspiracy, what's involved with the doping? What were and what did the doping enable, for lack of a better way to say it?
Well, two things. First of all, there was testosterone and corticosteroids, which are really recovery agents, and they're banned. And he was found to have used that in his initial tour, and corticosteroids, he failed to test for that, but they came and found a backdated, they had one of their doctors backdate a prescription. But that's sort of minor. The big thing about cycling is, like cross-country skiing or running, it's a pure endurance sport, and so the ability to process oxygen is very important. EPO is a blood-boosting drug that allows you to create more red blood cells and increase your level of red blood cells, which is called the hematocrit. And if you get over 50% hematocrit, you're going to be doing very well.
So and that's because the oxygen lets your muscles do better than they would without it.
That's right. You're able to generate more energy. You won't get as fatigued because you have and your 5 or 10% increase in performance based. And if the performance is ride 120 miles as fast as you can and finish at the top of a 10 mile climb up a very steep mountain, that extra oxygen carrying capacity is going to make a big difference.
And as you said earlier, the Tour is all about this mountain climbing. But the idea that people cheat is one thing. That sounds to me, as I understand what the Anti-Doping Agency says, that he not only cheated, he was kind of an evangelical cheater and also sort of a master of a cover-up.
Well, that's right. And let me just say one more thing about it. First, there was EPO. They developed a test for EPO, and they implemented it in 2000. So then he switched, and they continued to microdose EPO, but they used blood transfusions, because the other way you can increase your blood carrying capacity is you give yourself blood transfusions of banked red blood cells. You put them in during the tour, and then you've got an extra boost, a real blood booster during the tour. And some of the most horrific stories are of some of his riders literally getting blood transfusions. They tape the bag to the wall of the apartment or the hotel room, and they're being transfused in there. Somebody's watching the door to make sure nobody comes in and sees them. And then these riders are fearful that somebody, because the blood has been banked for almost a month sometimes, mm-hmm. and they're fearful that it wasn't refrigerated properly, it didn't have the right plasma massaging to make sure that it worked well, and they were fearful that they were going to have a bad kidney response.
Right. So first, yuck. And then second, after yuck, what's tomorrow, I gather, the World Cycling Agency is going to decide whether they agree with what the Anti-Doping Agency says?
Yeah, that's right. So the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency came out with their decision, and actually your clip was right on point because it talked about quitting. A lot of people say, hey, Lance didn't get a fair shake here. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency has a conspiracy for him. That's not true at all. He had an opportunity to challenge these findings, to cross-examine the witnesses and the riders who testified against him, but he gave up. He quit. He tried to file a lawsuit in Texas to stop it. When that was rejected, he said, you know what, I'm done. I'm not going to fight it. When he did that, it's the same thing as a no contest plea in a criminal case. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency decided, all right, you've accepted the sanction. You've decided not to arbitrate, to challenge our evidence. Therefore, your tours are going to be stripped, all seven of them, and you're banned from cycling for life.
And you went through at the beginning of the conversation, you described the evidence, and it's, candidly, it sounds like it's longer than the health care bill.
It is 11:15 in the morning. This is 96.9 Boston Talks, and this is Josh Davis. And we have the most significant guest of the morning on the show. I mean, candor, Mark's the only guest of the morning. But Mark Leibovich of the New York Times, welcome to 96.9 Boston Talks.
Good to be here, Josh.
So Mark and I have known each other for a very long time, I think all the way back to elementary school.
We go back to the main streets of Newton.
It's true. A lot of violence in our youth.
Totally.
And Mark...
Emotional violence.
Well, it's true, and most of it imposed by parents who really didn't know what they were doing.
Exactly.
A couple weeks ago, maybe a little more than that, you wrote a piece in the Times comparing Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. And as much as they want us to think that they couldn't be more different, you seem to think they were a little bit alike.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of overlap in the two of them. I mean, these are both very, very serious, sort of data-minded people. I mean, I think they would both be described as introverts. And these are people who, I mean, I think one of the dirty little secrets about politics is a lot of people who are in the game are actually quite shy. And one of the things that sort of self-selects them to this profession is actually a sort of... something that forces them out of what might be a more cerebral existence.
And why is the shy thing? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine, but the response to feeling shy would be, I'd like to stand up in front of thousands of screaming people and tell them why I should be their leader.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, I remember Tom Daschle, the former Senate Majority Leader, I did a story on him a few years ago, and he said, you know, it's amazing how many people in the Senate are like this, and I guess it's a way to kind of sort of force yourself to be someone that you might not naturally suited to, and I think that there's obviously affirmation involved in being a public person. There's obviously vulnerability and great insecurity involved, but I think that these are all... you know, these are all facets that you see commonly in a lot of politicians.
So it's a little like when you meet people who are psychiatrists, one of the underlying questions needs to be what's wrong with them.
Exactly.
Now, what about the number two people? First, why don't we take Paul Ryan first, because I want to pause on Joe Biden for a little while. I know a lot about what he stands for. I don't know much about him as a person. What can you tell us about him?
You know, not a heck of a lot more than what I have read and what I have seen and what I've been around. I mean, I met him a couple times. I mean, he did, I do think he's comported himself pretty well in the first week. He does exude a certain freshness and a youth that, frankly, has been missing in a race in which you've had three other principals, if you include Biden, who've been running for president for many, many, many years. I think, obviously, you know, a campaign is a full MRI test on your temperament, on your soul, on your makeup. So I guess we'll see that going forward.
Right. What about his? I imagine people said that about Howard Dean.
Yeah.
So what about his speech last week?
I think the Republicans, I mean the Romney campaign specifically, has spent not a lot of energy, or at least some would say not enough energy, sort of defining who Mitt Romney is, why he would be an effective leader, what he would do as president, and are really banking on what they perceive to be the failure of the Obama administration in the first 2-4 years.
Well, we're going to talk about that with the listeners when we get back. And Mark, congratulations on surviving the mean streets of Newton and making it to where you are, and for joining us on 96.9 Boston Talks.
It's a pleasure, Josh.
Talk to you soon, Mark.
Okay, bye-bye.
Josh Davis is on News Talk 96.9.
And the reason our founding fathers did that was to allow them to exercise their best judgment as to what the Constitution requires and what the law should be. In our history, from time to time, that has enabled the court to do great things that the political branches of our government were not able to do. notable among them, Brown versus Board of Education and the desegregation of our schools. Elected officials could not figure out how to do or could not do that because of political realities. The court could. The court has stood up for freedom of speech in New York Times versus Sullivan at a time when, candidly, the political branches of our government couldn't figure out how to deal with the complexities of Watergate and the Vietnam War. At its best, the court delivers judgments as to how things are supposed to work in a way that isn't about who appointed judges or not. And now that patriotic notion is reaffirmed today by, of all people, Chief Justice John Roberts, because what's most interesting, aside from the result about this opinion, is the way the judges voted. Every single person who watches the court, and I'm in this group too, imagine that, as in almost every other opinion over the last number of years, the swing vote would be Anthony Kennedy. The court typically divides into two four-vote packages. On the more left, though not quite left anymore, the argument that there are real liberals on the court is a tough one to make, consists of Breyer, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. The right wing is reliably Roberts, Scalia, Alito, and Thomas, and Justice Kennedy is the swing vote.
And that's why they thought with a conservative majority that it would have been defeated.
Well, yeah, and why everybody watching the argument was so stunned by how vehement Kennedy's opposition to the individual mandate seemed to be, and so
right.
people thought this was done.
Right.
And lo and behold, Justice Roberts did what, and this is my point about the court, he did what justices are supposed to do. He sat, he thought, and what he realized is something that a lot of people who are not politicians have said about this law, which is, wait a second, this whole broccoli thing,
right.
which is
That's right.
the government
That's
is forcing
right.
us to buy broccoli or forcing us to buy health insurance, misses the point.
That's right.
What really is here is a fine. If you choose not to own health insurance, you pay a tax.
Before you go any further, I know you've been hammering Graham
done hammering Graham.
Okay, well, he's gone about to hammer you because he couldn't resist. He's a couple of hours away from his show, but he's chomping at the bit. So Michael Graham's joining us on the hotline right
Excellent.
Now. Hold on, Josh. Michael, now let me ask you, right before you start, I know you're steaming, but before you start, your initial reaction to the decision by the Supreme Court is what?
I'm not steaming at all. I mean, obviously, I'd like to dump it because I think it's bad policy. But if you listen to my show yesterday, the only topic of conversation was the notion that the Commerce Clause has no limit, that the government can force you to do anything it wants in the area of health care, which means, of course, because everything's related to your health, from what to eat to where you vacation, the government would have no limit. The only part that puts the America that I live in at risk is the notion of this unlimited government power, and that's the part that got shot down. So I am absolutely celebrating. I mean, you could absolutely have a system where we all pay into one payer, or we all, you know, have a health care tax. In fact, the way I would fix health care for America would be with a tax, a catastrophic care tax. I would just take away everything else.
So today's a good day for
you.
It's horrible. For politics, I just have to cut one thing, Josh. You have to correct your statement that there are no liberals on the Elena Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor. You're absolutely. I can't find a liberal on there anyway. What do you define it as a liberal?
So all I'd say, Michael,
Lenin.
Let's do two pieces. No, Lenin is a different character. We don't have a Brennan or a Marshall liberal on the court anymore. Is my point.
You're right. We have an Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor liberal. They're knee jerk, so they're not very smart.
I think they're less smart than Brennan Marshall. I also think, honestly, they're less liberal, which is why this court doesn't do as much as it might otherwise do.
Hey, boys, I hate to interrupt the Graham and Davis show, but the Doug Meehan show needs to continue with a commercial break.